The plan to build a gas storage facility to feed the petrochemical industry in the region has a lot of vocal critics.
Petrochemicals are not energy. It's plastic. It's a dead product that doesn't go anywhere.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, residents of the Ohio Valley question an economic future based on plastic. And area high school kids are thinking about their future as part of a new generation of utility workers.
There's plenty of jobs out there that pay really well and you don't need a four-year degree for, and these jobs are needed.
Plus, Pittsburgh's rivers, once rife with pollution, were no place for wildlife like mussels or salamanders. But things are changing.
We're starting to see more diversity, more species, more numbers in both the Allegheny and the Ohio River.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. A bill aimed at saving two of Pennsylvania's nuclear power plants from early retirement is getting an unexpectedly mixed reception in the state Senate. WITF's Katie Meyer reports the first committee hearing on the measure saw nuclear and natural gas proponents clash over how to make Pennsylvania's energy markets fair.
The proposal would recognize the Commonwealth's five nuclear power plants as carbon-free energy and add them to a list of clean energy sources electric utilities are required to buy. Gas lobbyists like Marcellus Shale Coalition President Dave Spiegelmeyer argued nuclear plants are already mostly profitable and say giving them a leg up is unfair.
This is not a battle between the gas industry or the electric industry. This is a battle being waged against your constituents, the ratepayer of Pennsylvania.
The bill is expected to add about $1.53 per month to the average consumer's electric bill. Lancaster County GOP Senator Ryan Aument, who's sponsoring the bill, argues it'll pay off in terms of jobs and low carbon emissions.
We will end up paying far more in the future if our nuclear power plants are permitted to prematurely retire.
A parallel bill in the House has gotten similar responses. Without intervention, the Three Mile Island nuclear reactor near Harrisburg is expected to close in September. The Beaver Valley plant outside Pittsburgh faces a 2021 retirement. Katie Meyer in Harrisburg.
Well, no matter if the power comes from natural gas or nuclear, utility companies have an age problem. Across Pennsylvania, 28% of their workforce is expected to retire in the next 5 years. State Impact Pennsylvania's Amy Sisk looks at how one power company hopes to replace those workers.
It's quiet in this classroom at Duquesne Light, the company that supplies electricity to most of Allegheny and Beaver counties.
I'm just kind of drawing like an A-frame house with a garage on the side and nice front porch.
Lewis Charlier of Beaver Area High School is one of 10 students sketching their dream homes. He's hunched over drawing his from three angles, straight on, from the side, and a bird's eye view. This is a lesson on blueprints, something the students will become familiar with if they pursue careers with the electric power company. The teens have arranged their schedules to be here for a few hours each afternoon as part of Duquesne Light's new student boot camp.
They take classes around mathematics, reading comprehension.
Selena Gregg is with the company.
We're also doing soft skill classes on interview skills, resume writing, as well as an OSHA 10 class and a CPR class.
The power supplier will host a similar program for high school teachers this summer. Debbie Kilmeyer is with the Community College of Allegheny County, which is partnering with Duquesne Light to host the camps.
If teachers don't know about the positions or some of the technical things that are out there for their students, they're not able to talk to their students and share those experiences.
It was a teacher at Charlier's school who heard about the boot camp from a Duquesne Light employee and suggested he apply.
I don't really want to go to college because I don't really like school, how it's all set up and everything. I'd rather just go like straight into the workforce or like do a trade, something along those lines.
On day two of the camp, something Charlier heard from one of the company's executives caught his attention.
He told us that this job opportunity is going to be like having a $3 million lottery ticket.
$3 million. That's how much these students could expect to make over the course of their careers if they work in a skilled trade at Duquesne Light. As a line worker, for example, installing and repairing power lines, their starting salary would be $65,000 to $85,000, plus overtime. That sounds pretty good to Charlier.
There's plenty of jobs out there that pay really well and you don't need a four-year degree for, and these jobs are needed.
They're needed across Pennsylvania. Power companies from Duquesne Light to First Energy to PECO are active in recruiting new workers, running programs and internships to give prospective employees hands-on experience. The Public Utility Commission is working on this issue, too. Here's Chairman Gladys Brown.
The baby boomers are starting to retire.
The PUC last year launched a utility careers campaign to promote the industry to young people and to military veterans by talking up the positions at job fairs and other events. While the workforce shortage is a challenge, Brown says it's not dire. The PUC keeps close tabs on utilities' performance to ensure that outages don't become too frequent and that response times are reasonable.
You want to make sure that you have the appropriate skilled, trained personnel on hand to deal with providing that reliable service.
For Duquesne Light, that means keeping a steady stream of potential workers going through training. This boot camp is a first step. Students who complete it will take an exam, and if they're successful, they can move on to what's known as pole school. Here's Greg again.
I think a lot of people come in and they don't realize if they're scared of heights or if they're able to climb to the top of a pole and then be able to work with their hands.
The next step is a year-long program at the Community College of Allegheny County to learn the ins and outs of working for the electric distribution company. Charlier can't wait.
I did well in like all the practice exams, so I feel like I'm going to pass that test, and I feel like I can climb a pole.
That could make him part of a new generation of workers tasked with keeping the lights on. Amy Sisk, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
An almost decade-long effort to build a major underground storage facility for natural gas liquids in the Ohio Valley saw movement recently, as West Virginia and federal politicians announced initiatives to move it forward. But as Brittany Patterson reports, not everyone is on board.
People over petro, people over plastics, people over profit.
About 40 protesters gathered Tuesday outside a natural gas and manufacturing conference in Morgantown. Inside the conference, officials and business representatives from across the Ohio Valley discussed their vision for the region to make it the nation's next center for plastics manufacturing. But outside, holding colorful signs, some with plastic grocery bags attached that whipped in the wind, environmental activists rejected that vision. Bev Reed lives in Belmont County, Ohio.
Petrochemicals are not energy. It's plastic. It's a dead product that doesn't go anywhere except to poison people.
Officials from West Virginia, Ohio, and Pennsylvania support efforts to bring cracker plants and other plastics manufacturing infrastructure to the region. The Ohio Valley sits on one of the nation's most productive natural gas and natural gas liquids repositories. Lawmakers in favor of the proposed petrochemical expansion cite an American Chemistry Council study that projects the industry would bring 100,000 jobs to the region. But that same study estimates 60% of plastic production would be for food products, an investment potentially at odds with the times, as cities and companies around the globe pledge to discontinue use of single-use plastics. Protester BJ McManima with the Indigenous Environmental Network pushed back on the argument that a petrochemical future is the only one that can bring new jobs to the area.
They shout jobs, 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 making our concerns sound like we don't want jobs. We want handouts. We don't want you guys to have jobs. No, that's not right. No, we want clean, safe, sustainable jobs that create resilient, happy, and peaceful communities.
Those opposed to the petrochemical build-out say they've struggled to be heard by elected officials. Lawmakers remain steadfast. To woo plastics manufacturers to the region, natural gas liquid storage must be built. The Appalachian Storage and Trading Hub has been in the works for almost a decade. Developers are seeking billions in loan guarantees from the federal government. Here's West Virginia Governor Jim Justice speaking at another natural gas conference earlier this year.
The number one economic focus of my office today is the natural gas hub.
This week, Justice met with officials from the U.S. Department of Energy to discuss the hub and developing the petrochemical industry in West Virginia. In a press release, the governor said he would appoint a liaison to work with the Energy Department on these issues. West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin also introduced a bill this week to help make a different case for the hub. The legislation would task the Energy Department with studying its national security benefits. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Brittany Patterson.
A natural treasure, a gem of green space and spring pools, doesn't always look that way from the outside.
Some thought it was an eyesore. Some were afraid of the seemingly stagnant water and mosquitoes. Others coveted the land for homes.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, how a paradise for salamanders was saved by a biology teacher who saw something more valuable than a housing development. Stay tuned. The industrialization of Pittsburgh's rivers, the coal mines, the steel mills, and dams made the water inhospitable for a lot of aquatic species. Some largely disappeared, unable to survive in the mud and pollution. For our series, Wild PA, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant headed out with some researchers to survey wildlife in the rivers. They're trying to determine if two troubled species in particular are bouncing back, the mud puppy salamander and the endangered mussel that it needs to survive.
To be honest, I've hardly ever thought about mussels. Recently, a woman next to me at a bar ordered a plate of them with garlic butter. That sounded good. But then I met Nevin Welty, who spends his time studying mussels.
I'm with the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission. I'm a mussel biologist.
I met him and his colleague at a boat ramp about 20 miles northeast of Pittsburgh on the Allegheny River. We headed out in their research boat to check spots where they've been trying to catch mud puppy salamanders. Welty says the mud puppies are necessary for the survival of salamander mussels. He says river mussels are simple.
It's basically a clam that you might find in the ocean, but it's a clam in fresh water.
River mussels are not those much-loved, slightly chewy bivalves found in oceans and coveted by seafood lovers. Their taste has been compared more closely with a dirty shoe. But Welty says freshwater mussels are good for the river.
They just sit down there and they filter water and serve as habitat for bugs and then also food for things like fish and muskrats and otters. They're a pretty important part of the food chain.
Zoologist Ryan Miller of the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy slows down the boat as we approach a small orange buoy not far from the shoreline.
This is a buoy line, so we can find it every day. I just got to try to keep the boat straight.
Meanwhile, Nevin Welty reaches a long pole into the water and with a hook on the end of it, grabs the buoy and pulls the rope it's attached to.
Got it.
A cement block emerges, the anchor. He keeps pulling, and cylinder metal traps emerge from the water, one by one, each bigger in size than a football. He lines them up on the boat. There's no mud puppy salamanders.
Okay. We'll put some bait in them and send them back out.
Miller opens a can of sardines and drops the oily fish into the traps. Welty tosses the traps one by one back into the water. He drops the anchor, and then Miller steers the boat further up the river. They're checking 100 traps like this today. At the next research site, Welty starts pulling out another set of traps.
There's one there.
Hey, we got a mud puppy.
He keeps pulling the line.
All right, two.
Yeah, buddy.
Miller lifts out one of the mud puppies. It's nearly a foot long, brown, and slimy, but around its neck, it's got a distinctive flare, these reddish, feathery gills.
When you pull them out of the water, they get pretty feisty, so try not to handle them with my hands too much.
He flips the salamander over and takes a look.
That's a female there.
Miller measures its length and weight, he takes its picture, then runs his finger along those frilly red gills. This is where the mussels come in. Their larvae attach themselves to mud puppy gills.
It'd be just like little white spots on the red gills, but I don't see any, so.
Miller tests the mud puppy from the second trap, then releases both back into the water, and we head to the next site. Even though they haven't found any larvae in the gills, Nevin Welty, the biologist, marvels at those unique salamander muscles.
But just that they use an amphibian, and like, how did that evolve? And, you know, versus, you know, where most muscles use fish. I don't know. It just is mind-blowing.
After 2 or 3 weeks, the larvae drop off the mud puppy gills. Then the juvenile mussels finish their growth in the rocks and debris near the banks of the river. But freshwater mussels have struggled with pollution in this region. Welty says the salamander mussels were officially declared endangered in Pennsylvania in 2010, following contamination at Dunkard Creek along the West Virginia border. A Consol Energy mine had discharged salty pollutants into the creek, causing algae blooms that killed 15,000 freshwater mussels and 6,000 mud puppies.
We trapped Dunkard Creek for mud puppies over the past couple seasons, too, and we've only found one individual.
That's just one single mud puppy. There isn't much research to show how many mud puppies once lived in the Ohio River or the Allegheny, where we are today. But Ryan Miller says surveys like the one they're doing give him reason for hope.
Any type of large-scale pollution event would essentially kill them, but right now they're doing okay.
And if this round of surveying finds enough mud puppies, researchers are considering relocating some of them to Dunkard Creek. They hope to repopulate not only the salamanders there, but also the mussels that need them. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
In Appalachian coal country, thousands of miles of streams run orange with pollution called acid mine drainage. It's the same pollution that's killed off mussels and fish for decades. But if some researchers have their way, acid mine drainage and other coal waste could produce valuable products called rare earth elements. They're essential to many high-tech products. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Glynis Board has this story, which first ran last year.
Paul Zimkevich is standing in front of a silo full of crushed limestone that slowly gets flushed into a stream pouring out of an old coal mine here. It's a state-of-the-art, state-operated facility that treats acid mine drainage. If it weren't here, the stream would run rusty red, killing ecosystems in its path.
Okay, so we're at the Omega Mine, and the Omega Mine is about 4.5 miles south of Morgantown, West Virginia. And it's an area that's been heavily mined for coal since the Civil War.
Zimkevich, the director of the West Virginia Water Research Institute at West Virginia University, was awarded $2.6 million federal dollars plus funds from the private sector. His research aims to locate, isolate, and commercialize select hard-to-gather elements of the periodic table, elements that are critical to the technology age we live in. Some of those elements can be found in acid mine drainage.
I finished up some calculations that the acid mine drainage production in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Eastern Ohio can supply anywhere between, and this is in terms of rare earth, somewhere between 800 tons per year to maybe 2,200 tons per year. 800 tons a year is basically what the military needs for defense purposes and contractors.
Zimkevich and a handful of other scientists in and around the Ohio Valley make up the majority of the American team dedicated to cracking the rare earth element puzzle. That is, the team that's on the hunt for rare earth elements and how to build an industry around them. The Americans are the underdogs. Right now, China is the team to beat, where 95% of the rare earths used in phones, electric cars, and smart bombs are all sourced.
In 2011, the prices of rare earth elements spiked, in part because of a supply problem from China. And so that instilled an interest in researching rare earth, other sources of rare earth elements throughout the world, but also in the United States.
Tom Tarka is the technical project lead for rare earth elements at the National Energy and Technology Laboratory in West Virginia, or NETL. He explains about 140,000 tons of rare earth elements are produced globally each year into products on the market. There's no commercially available alternative for sourcing rare earths outside of China. And since the U.S. doesn't want to have to rely on any single other nation to provide important components critical to national security, government funds are funneling into research at NETL in Morgantown, a national lab that focuses largely on coal and fossil fuel research. Mary Ann Alvin is the head of the rare earths division there.
Right now, what we have is actively 15 programs, 15 projects that are investigating not only separations, investigating where we can find our best reserves, and how can we take this forward.
Rare earth mines have tried and failed in the U.S. already. They just weren't profitable on their own. The hope now is that rare earth mining can be economically viable if it piggybacks on other mining operations, like coal. Tom Tarka from NETL explains that researchers have already begun to identify rare earth elements in and around coal seams, as well as those within waste products associated with mining and burning coal.
In Appalachian coals, especially Southern West Virginia and Central App, we're seeing more heavy rare earth elements. And that's good because these heavy rare earth elements, they're rarer and they have an increased value as a result.
The thing is, rare earths are not rare so much as rarely concentrated and hard to extract. It usually takes acids and harsh chemical processes, which create the stuff of environmental nightmares. But as Paul Zimkevich at the Water Research Institute knows well, West Virginia is already coping with environmental nightmares.
Before the Clean Water Act, the Monongahela River at Morgantown was orange and it had a pH of about 4.2. It was absolutely dead. There was hardly anything alive in it. The only difference between then and now is the amount of treatment that water gets before it winds up in the river. In the Mon River Basin, I think something like a third of all the acid mine drainage is actually being treated in industrial size operations.
So acids are literally seeping from coal mines everywhere throughout Appalachia and apparently leaching rare earth elements in the process.
It turns out that the more acid seams give us the best results because it has the most pyrite. Pyrite in turn generates the acid that leaches the rare earths out of the rock.
Zimkevich's research is not only identifying which elements exist in acid mine drainage, or AMD, and the sludge left from treatment of polluted water, but also how to process the elements and get them into a marketable form.
Rather than sludge disposal being a liability, if you could actually make some money on it, and it's probably not going to pay for all of the costs of AMD treatment, but even if it knocks down the cost by 20, 30, 40%, that's a very, very significant incentive to continue treating acid mine drainage.
And Zimkevich is just one researcher. Others in Kentucky and Pennsylvania are studying lots of other coal waste products like coal ash. There are literally mountains of discarded coal ash throughout the region. Coal scientists estimate that with continued research and the right economic pressure, a rare earth industry in the Ohio Valley could exist in 10 to 20 years.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Glynis Board.
One way that you know it's really spring, peepers. I'm not talking about Easter chicks. Spring peepers are little brown frogs. In an early spring, they breed in small bodies of water and vernal pools, pockets of melted snow and rain that dry up by the summer. Salamanders also benefit from these bits of water. Back in 2007, Allegheny Front commentator Chuck Starsnick visited a muddy bog just north of Pittsburgh to witness another rite of spring. Here's his recollection of that place from our archives.
Salamander Park is an enormous, leaf-strewn puddle in the forest. It looks like a mistake, like a half-finished excavation, abandoned and flooded. A skinny sycamore leans in the middle like the derelict mast of a sunken sailboat. The shallow water beneath is perfectly still. The place is rank with mud and rot and life. I first came here a few years ago on a stormy night in early spring. Rain tumbled through the bare branches and pattered on the forest floor. I shined my flashlight in the shallows and the improbable creature came into focus. A stout black salamander longer than my hand, sporting bright yellow spots. More salamanders came until there were dozens, swirling silently about in a lumbering aquatic ballet. Their sperm packets appeared like little white mushrooms upon the leaves and sticks around them. The rest of this process is difficult to observe, but a female picks up a few of these sperm packets in her cloaca, the vent at the base of her tail. About a week later, she lays clumps of fertilized eggs that cling to submerged vegetation. The adults return to the forest and will probably not be seen above ground for another year. The embryos develop over several weeks in this vernal pool. When they hatch, they are something like tadpoles, little aquatic predators with frilly external gills. The pool may dry up in the heat of summer, but before that happens, the juvenile salamanders grow, lose their gills, and take shelter in the forest. The salamanders are bound to this fickle resource. They almost never breed in larger, more permanent bodies of water where fish and turtles would prey on the eggs. I've always found it surprising that this soggy patch of suburban wood has endured so close to the city, nestled in the fork of two busy roads where the rush of cars rises and falls like the wind. So many similar wetlands have been lost. Then I learned just weeks ago that this land was going to be developed in the 1960s, until a high school biology teacher named Beulah Fry became involved. Beulah Fry was born in 1921. As a beginning teacher, she taught mostly math until the principal noticed the passion she brought to biology. She took her students to study life at this pond, which she had visited as a girl. Then her students learned there were plans to fill the pond with earth and develop the property. People have their own ideas of what beauty is and what is needed in the world, she told me. Some thought it was an eyesore. Some were afraid of the seemingly stagnant water and mosquitoes. Others coveted the land for homes. Beulah Fry says she wouldn't have had the courage to speak at the township meeting if not for her students. She doesn't even remember what she said, just that she stood up and the words flowed out of her. After the meeting, a few of the men told her that she had just about made them cry. The borough of Fox Chapel voted to create Salamander Park. A few days ago, I went back there, hoping to see salamander eggs for the first time. It was sunny and warm, and the forest was awakening fast. Robins rustled the leaf litter all around, and the branches were flush with green. It was several minutes before I saw clumps of salamander eggs in deeper water, wrapped around sticks like large, ghostly marshmallows. As I rose to leave, I spotted a tiny raft of stuff at the water's edge. I dipped my hand beneath it and lifted. The water fell away, and a clear mass of jelly pooled across the width of my palm and outstretched fingers. Embryonic salamanders, evenly spaced and curled into tiny parentheses. I held them close to my face and stared as one, then another, twitched and flipped, fully alive, eager to spring forth upon the larger world, but for this moment, resting wholly in the palm of my hand.
That was commentator Chuck Starsnick. If you happen upon a vernal pool this spring and are lucky enough to spot a salamander, let us know on Twitter. We're at Allegheny Front. You can find more stories about wildlife and conservation at AlleghenyFront.org/WildPA. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show and our podcast, Trump on Earth. All 60 and counting of those episodes are at TrumpOnEarth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.